We've been doing the Say What series, in which we encounter some of Jesus's more difficult sayings and just some of the ones that kind of... I skipped the Ron Burgundy gift this morning, so if you need that, you can just, you know, type in, what did you say? And hopefully that'll pop up for you. I want to start with this quote by... I've been reading this book, and it's by a guy named Douglas Jones. It's called Dismissing Jesus, How We Evade the Way of the Cross, and which is typical for us because we like to choose the path of least resistance, right? So he has this quote, and he actually has a whole chapter on enemy love. And here's he starts the chapter with this, and I remember reading this chapter and just the opening lines, and one part I'm laughing at it, and one part I'm incredibly convicted, and one part I'm like, I got to tell everybody I know that he said this. But he has this just great opening paragraph in his book in which he says, Christians don't believe in love. We don't believe love is a serious and thick force in the cosmos, a power that actually topples things. Love can't move mountains, we assume. We deny love as lightning that can explode trees or a dense river that cuts through granite. We even believe soft-tissued humans are stronger than love. We prefer intimidation and punishment to change people. If that's not enough, he keeps going. Even we Calvinists, who believe so much about God is irresistible, spend more pages discussing the legitimacy of the sword and civil magistrate than expositions of love. To most Christians, love is thin and frail, shattering on everything it touches. We believe love is fleeting and giggly like early romance. Love is a teenage crush, not something hard-headed for hard-headed life. So one part of me like, it's just like, wow. And then it's really convicting because when you really think about this, going back to this verse, we don't really believe in love, do we? Not in the way that some of the early Christians really believed in love. And when we talk about enemy love this morning, we go into this passage about when Jesus says, I want you to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. We often encounter Jesus' teachings as simply good advice, right? Oh, that's nice advice, Jesus. But when you read Jesus' teaching this morning, when you encounter the teaching of enemy love, right, I want us not to just read it this morning as, oh, that's good advice. I want us to read it as good news, right? Imagine on the news this morning you turn on and like me, you watch who watches CBS Sunday morning? Seriously, nobody watches this? Nobody watches CBS Sunday morning? The news magazine show about, no? Okay, I'll just talk to my, you turn on the news this morning and you watch Meet the Press? Does anybody watch TV on Sunday morning? Little Mermaid? I'm trying to think how I'm going to make the Little Mermaid work in this. But imagine you turn on the news tomorrow night. Does anybody watch the news at night? Okay, two people. And you say, great news. There's this new news that the way to live life is to love your enemy, right? So not just like, hey, this is good advice. But when Jesus comes, we can't just read his teachings as like, well, that's good advice for life. It is good news. It's heralding a new era or a new kingdom. So when we encounter this passage in Matthew 5, I think the first thing I want to say is, like, let's read it not just like, hey, Jesus is giving us some advice, maybe, if we choose to take it, right? Because when you read it like that, then we end up as these people. We don't really believe in it, right? It's kind of good advice that we can take or we can let go. When you read it as news, when you read it as a proclamation of a brand new way to live life, it changes. If someone were to say today, if you were to maybe go watch the news and somebody were to say, California, I saw this on the news the other night, has seceded from the United States. We are now an independent country. That would be news that would change the way that we live. I mean, maybe not immediately and directly, but it would be different, right? If you read the way of enemy love as news, as something new that Jesus is telling us and teaching us, right? You encounter it differently than just, maybe I'll do this and maybe I won't, right? So let's read it. Let's go back and look at Jesus's fun words about loving our enemies. Go to Matthew chapter 5, and we're going to read these five verses. By the way, did anybody see that on the news? That I think they're putting it on the ballot for next year, or they're trying to get enough signatures to put it on the ballot, that California would withdraw and become its own state. I mean, its own country. Nobody saw it. So I was watching that on the news. I was like, who are these people, and do they even have anything to do with their lives? Or just like, oh, I think this would be a good idea. Maybe we should, I'm sorry, maybe we should talk about desks with ellipticals underneath it. So Jesus says, everybody there, Matthew 5, 43 through 48, Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, isn't this fun? This is news, right? I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good. He sends the rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Don't even the pagans do that? And then he just ends with this, like, kind of gimme right here. Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now we'll get to that one maybe at another point, because that's just a whole nother sermon series right there. Yeah, Jesus, sure, be perfect, right? I've spent 35 years of my life not being perfect, but today. So he has these words, right? This good news that he's announcing to these people, this Sermon on the Mount, right? You've heard it said, and I'm going to tell you to love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Now, when you encounter this, Jesus says this. He says, you have heard it said. Now, if you were with us last week, that should be kind of a clue and a little light should go off. And it's just like, oh, you have heard it said. Well, Jesus is commenting on something here, right? He's commenting. He's midrashing. Remember we talked about last week about he's kind of filling in the gaps, right? So when you say, Jesus says, you've heard it said, where was it said, right? That's your first question. Where was that said? Where? Leviticus, what he's quoting here is Leviticus 19:18, right? Which Leviticus 19:18 says, do not seek revenge or bear a grudge against anyone among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. Now, as you read that paragraph and you think about Matthew 5, say 43, what's missing? Hate your enemy. Hate your enemy, right? So you have the command. So Jesus is saying, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But we don't have hate your enemy here in Leviticus 19, right? That's missing. So where is Jesus kind of, the question then would be, is where is Jesus kind of getting hate your enemies? Because as a command, hating enemies isn't found as a command in the Old Testament, right? There's nowhere in the Old Testament where God says, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, right? Now, there's a whole nother sermon about that being implied where you have God saying, kind of commanding, whether it would be, we've all heard these arguments where he commands genocide or he says, you wicked people, well, I'll have nothing to do with, or kind of a lot of that stuff. And there's all sorts of different directions we could talk about that. But it's important just to know kind of at the outset that hating enemies isn't found as a command in the Old Testament. So what Jesus is doing here is he's commenting on something that's actually happening in kind of contemporary society. Okay? So you have the love your neighbor. You've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. The hate your enemy is a language that's happening in kind of the contemporary circles that Jesus is in and around. Let me show them to you. First, the two most popular rabbis of the day, I don't even know if this is them, this is just a painting, this could be, I don't know. The two most popular rabbis of the day were a guy named Shammai and Hillel, and they kind of were the competing, they were the, I was thinking like, who's like the big evangelical powers right now? Rick Warren and Joel Osteen? Could that be a good, you know what I'm saying? Like those guys were like the big, like those, when you think about kind of like evangelical leaders in America, Rick Warren, Joel Osteen, or, you know, like those were like the, Shammai and Hillel were kind of like the big voices in Jesus's day, right? So Shammai, as he, again, as he's kind of Midrashing, as he's kind of filling in the gaps on Leviticus 19, what he thought that this Leviticus 19 verse implied, right, to love your neighbor as yourself, he thought that it implied that you would then hate your enemies. Now, how does he get from there to there? What he would say is that when you enter into a covenantal relationship, right, when you, the people of Israel were in this covenantal relationship with God, right, to be in that kind of covenant relationship, to love somebody, that therefore means that you have to hate or you have to forsake the others, right? So, for example, for me to love my wife in a covenantal relationship, right, I have to, in senses, hate or forsake other women in that sort of relationship. Does that make sense? Right? So this is kind of the way that Shammai gets to it. And this is his teaching, is that you love your neighbors, but as far as those outside of our neighborhood, right, because we are in this covenantal relationship with God and one another, we are to forsake or to hate the other people. Right? So Shammai, one of the big voices in the day, one of the big rabbis, this is his teaching. So Jesus says, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. He's commenting probably on this guy, Shammai. The other person he's commenting, or the other kind of group that he's commenting on is this. This is a picture of Masada. And in Masada, there is a group called the Qumran community. Does anybody know who or what the Qumran community is famous for? Who said it? My mom said it, and then, right? You should know, they're famous for the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? We went and saw the Dead Sea Scrolls a couple months ago. Is that one? Yeah? And so on the left, you have this picture of the kind of Qumran community. And what the Qumran community did is they just said, the world is going to hell in a handbasket, right? Jerusalem is corrupt. Rome is overrunning everything. So we're going to withdraw ourselves into the desert, and we're going to set up our own community, right? Our own fortress. And we're going to be the righteous. We're going to be the chosen. We're going to be we're going to protect everything. And of course, eventually Rome overtakes them. But then in, was it 48? Is that when they found? I'm trying to think. When they found the Dead Sea Scrolls? Huh? 48, 47. In the right-hand picture, you have you can kind of see these little caves in the mountain. Remember we talked about this? These shepherd boys running around throwing rocks up into the hills. And they hear broken pottery. And they go up and they find all these Dead Sea Scrolls from the Qumran community, from the Essenes in the Qumran community. So they find this scroll, and the Essenes have this rule of community that they adhere to, and let me show it to you. The rule of community says that they may love all that, basically that Yahweh has chosen, right, and hate all he has rejected. Right? So again, Jesus says, love your neighbors, hate your enemies. He's commenting on Shammai. He's probably commenting to a certain sense on these Qumran, the Essenes that have kind of retreated out to the desert. And then he's commenting on one other thing that I think that he's saying here. And he's deconstructing this idea that the Jews had kind of come to think of, is that because we have been chosen by God, we're God's favorite, right? And God only loves us, right? And the rest of the people, God doesn't love, right? And what Jesus, again, he deconstructs, because this is the popular mentality. This is the, Elliot, can I use manifest destiny, right? When there was manifest destiny and people thought, it's all for us, right? We are the destiny is ours. It's, you know what I mean? And so the kind of mindset in that time was, because we are God's chosen people, we are therefore his favorite people. And everybody else doesn't matter, right? And Jesus begins to say, look, you have been chosen. And he always goes back to Abraham. And he says, when Abraham kind of comes into the scene, remember God says to Abraham, I will bless you, right? Or I'll choose you so that what? So that you can be a blessing to others. And Jesus is just reiterating this. He says, I'll choose you so that you can be the light of the world, so that you can be the salt of the earth, so that you can be heralds of the kingdom of heaven, right? He even would tell a story about, who is my neighbor, right? And Jesus says, well, there's a story about a man who went from Jericho to Jerusalem, and along the way, he got in trouble with some robbers, and the priests and the Levites walked by. But the Samaritan, right? Was the Samaritan the chosen one? No, he was the rejected one. He was the one kicked out, right? So Jesus is taking this kind of popular mindset of like, hey, we're the chosen, we're the favorite ones, and he's breaking it down. So he's, in essence, when he teaches this passage, right, he's probably speaking towards Shammai or the popular preachers of the day. He's speaking towards these communities that have withdrawn and said, we're, you know, we got to preserve and, you know, we're the only chosen ones. And he's just kind of speaking towards this general kind of mindset of we are the chosen, we are the favorite, we are the ones that God has this, it's just us, right? It's like us saying like, we are the church, right? Cottonwood doesn't know what they're doing and the Baptist church is, we are the, you know. And Jesus is like, no, we need to talk about that. You're not chosen just so you can sit here and be God's favorite. So what I want to do this morning is, because Jesus got after all these different things, right? And when I think about this passage about enemy love, what's your default setting towards, sometimes enemies might be too strong of a word. What's your default setting towards people who you don't particularly like, who irritate you, who rub you the wrong way? Right? I'll give you a couple clues. When we encounter enemies, right, people who we are really against, typically the default setting is aggression, violence, sanctions, right? Think about the way that we treat, and sometimes you can think about this two ways. You can think largely about big enemies out there in the world, and you can think about people who you just hate, who you just have that thought, I'd rather they not be a part of my life, you know? And our default setting towards our enemies is often violence and aggression and sanctions and withdrawal. And we have this mechanism built up that if somebody hurts us, we just push them away, right? And what I want to do this morning is I want to deconstruct what I think is a big narrative or myth in our culture. And it's called this. I'm going to talk about it two ways. I'm going to call it the narrative of redemptive violence, right? Because our default setting, the default setting that you and I have, right, towards our enemies would be violence or aggression or sanctions. And we think to ourselves, like, that's going to modify their behavior. Walter Wink, and I'm going to talk about this book. He wrote this great book. It's called The Powers That Be. And I'm reading this book. This was maybe a year or two ago I'm reading this book. And he has this chapter called The Myth of Redemptive Violence. And it was kind of as, I think it was like 2 years ago, because I think Julia was about 2 years old, and she was just kind of starting to get to the age where if she misbehaved, I kind of felt like spanking was appropriate, right? So, and I kind of would always joke, and maybe even heard me joke about this, was like, oh, I can't, like, I got whooped when I, who got whooped when they were a kid? Like, right? I got whooped when I was a kid. I'm like, I cannot wait to whoop some tail when it's my turn. You know what I mean? Like, and maybe, did anybody ever hear me joke about that? Like, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna whoop that girl's tail when she gets out of line. Like, that was my kind of default setting. I was like, damn, when she gets out of line, I'm gonna. And I'm reading Wink's book about this myth of redemptive violence, and the light goes on to me that says, I live under the false assumption that through violence and aggression towards my daughter, I'll change her behavior, right? And it was this kind of moment of like, that's exactly what, and again, we can have this whole nature versus nurture, you know, but this was the light came off. I was like, wait a second, I'm just going to change her behavior by being aggressive, because that's what we are socialized into, isn't it, right? Now, Wink goes on to, this is amazing. He goes on to talk about how, and he calls his chapter The Myth of Redemptive Violence, right? And he just says that it's a lie. He says that if you think that by adding more and more and more punishment and aggression, you're going to change people's behavior, you're wrong, right? I call it the narrative of redemptive violence because this is the predominant narrative that we live in our culture. This is the predominant story that we're told again and again and again. And he begins to talk about this, and he says, look at these two ways that this is told in our culture. And he talks about media, and he talks about the state, right? Now, I want to show you the top five movies from this year. Think about the theme in each one of these movies, except for one. Right? What's the theme, except for Inside Out, which is a story about emotions, having emotions. What's the theme in every one of these movies? That we will overcome violence with what?
Violence.
With violence, right? Have you ever thought about how often, think about TV shows. This is what we're spoon-fed day in. I've seen all of these movies and I was like, I'm just feeding myself this myth, this lie, right? The culture again sells it as a narrative. It sells it as the story that I will overcome violence by adding more violence. Think about the TV shows that we watch, right? These are like the top TV shows, so to speak, of our time, right? Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, The Walking Dead, these are the ones that say, good morning, that will say, we will overcome violence with more violence. The whole Western theme, genre of movies, right? How do you deal with violence in the West? You draw your gun faster than the other person, right? American football, what's the theme of American football, right? Concussions, right? You will be more violent than this is the most popular sport in America by far, and the theme is you will overcome, and we're all going to go home, I'm going to go home and watch football today. You will overcome, you will be more violent. The way that you gain victory is through violence. I thought about all the things, and Wink's just talking about this, and I'm just like, it was like all the lights on the string just went off in my head. I grew up watching G.I. Joe. I love G.I. Joe. What's the theme of G.I. Joe? You will beat Cobra Commander. Huh? Knowing is half the battle. Now you know that the theme, right? You will overcome Cobra Commander by more violence. I love Transformers. You will beat so-and-so by more violence. I love, the Power Rangers. You will beat whoever it was by more violence. This just goes on and on. If you're the old school folks and you liked the Lone Ranger, right? You will, and it's this, again, this is the narrative. Think about this. Now you're starting to think like, oh my gosh, this has this major theme. Again, now kids are, the adolescent kids, the Hunger Games. How do you topple the state? You have to be more violent than the state. I don't even know what that is about. You will beat the vampires or the Wolverine? What is it? The Wolverines and the vampires? Katie? You got nothing? Huh? Just go ahead. But I do know about this. What is the most money-making movie franchise right now? Huh? The Marvel comic book, the entire comic book genre that has dominated for the last 15 years, right? Is this whole narrative that the way that you, and Wink just talks about this and he says, by the time a kid is 18 years old, he'll consume 36 hours of television and watch 15,000 murders, right? And it's all sold in, but you know what? The way that you overcome violence is with more violence, right? Are you with me on that? This is I love it because Wink calls it the myth of redemptive violence, but I just say this is the story that we're fed. It's a narrative, right? It's what our predominant culture sort of says. You want to have violence, you want to beat violence, you want to beat dominion or domination, you just got to add more and more and more, and finally you'll end up on top, right? And everybody's thinking about like, oh yeah, that show that I watch is redemptive violence. And that show that I watch is redemptive violence. That movie that I just saw is redemptive violence. And that thing growing up as a kid is a redemptive violence. This is just what we're, unless you grew up watching Barney and Mr. Rogers and Sesame Street, But the majority of things that we watch is this narrative of redemptive violence. He then talks about the state. And really, when you talk about the state, there can be no gods before the nation, right? The nation is the God. Rick, when you walk through the airport, you're probably very familiar with all three of these machines, right? Why do we have to walk through these machines? Because we have to, we have to, the state can tell you who, what, when. They will, do you remember the one on the right was that kind of weird magnetic entry scan that people got so fired up because it was basically almost like x-ray in people's bodies, right? And it was kind of graphic in some senses, you know, but people are like, well, it's for the safety of the state. The state is the God, right? We just remembered 9/11, right? Now, we did all this great memorial stuff about the heroes and about the people who rushed in to save lives. But what's the theme underneath the theme of 9/11? What happens when violence is acted towards us? We return with greater levels of violence. You want to fly 2 or 3 or 4 airplanes into our buildings? We will fly 200 or 300 or 400 airplanes into your country, right? We will just escalate and escalate the violence. During the first Gulf War, I found this quote, and Wink had quoted this guy, where he says that there was this theologian, Michael Novak, who declared on NPR that we should thank God that so few died. And he's talking about the Gulf War here, the first Gulf War back in the early 90s. We should thank God that so few died in the fighting. And he was referring to the 150 or so Americans who were killed in that first Gulf War. But at that point, the casualty of the Iraqis was over 100,000. They were all children of God, right? See, the question we have to ask is, how do we deal with ISIS right now, right? Isn't this what dominates the news? What do we do about ISIS, right? Do we send more cruise missiles? Our greatest plane, the F-35, do we put boots on the ground? Do we do more drone strikes? Do we do snipers? Remember what Douglas Jones says at the beginning is, we prefer intimidation and punishment to change people. Since this crisis with ISIS, since this ISIS kind of outbreak, I was thinking about this. Has anybody heard one prominent pastor or theologian say, let's have a day of fasting and prayer for them? Have we had a lot of conversations about, well, should we put boots on the ground? Should we do more drone strikes? Should we, right? So, again, we live in this state that says the way that we'll deal with, this is why I call it the narrative of redemptive violence. This way that we'll deal with violence is by adding more violence. And we think about these terrorists, and as we're considering drone strikes and cruise missiles and boots on the ground, we often forget that half of our entire New Testament was written by converted terrorists. Paul's running around in the first century killing Christians, right? And he ends up writing half of our New Testament. We are fed this. This is the narrative, again, that we live in. That we will overcome violence with violence. Now, what actually overcomes violence? What overcomes this? And Jesus says, it's enemy love. We love our enemies. Now, we often think like, okay, Jesus, well, let's fill in the gaps a little bit. What does it mean to, let's define love, right? I was reading this commentary. I love the way that he put it. I think this is just great for us to kind of consider. A guy named Michael Wilkins says it like this. He says, love is an unconditional commitment to an imperfect person in which I give myself to bring the relationship to God's intended purpose. Now, I want you to think about this next question, because you have the person that sits in the cubicle next to you. You have the person who lives down the street from you. You have the person who's your boss. And I want you to write this down, because whoever this person that's been, he or she has been stealing headspace in your morning already, all morning long, right? You know who it is. You know who this person is. Like, no, Lord, not that person. You've already said it like 14 times. You're going to write down, what does God want from this relationship? And how can I best give myself to bring it about? Right? I'm going to talk about, what does it mean to love? You're going to ask yourself, this enemy, this person who I despise, this group of people, what does God want from this relationship? And how can I best give myself to bring it about? The first thing Jesus does when he talks about enemy love, he says, you've heard it said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemy. And then what's the first thing he instructs us to do? To pray. right? Here's why he tells you to pray. And, you know, you think about that because you read that and I'm just like, oh, that's just kind of like the church answer, right? It's kind of the cliched, well, of course, Jesus is going to say to pray. Here's why Jesus tells you the first thing to do is to pray. The first thing to do is to pray is because the redemptive violence myth speaks for God. It does not listen for God to speak. That's why Jesus begins to tell us to pray, right? Because as soon as you say like, oh yeah, well, I know what I'm going to do for this guy. I'm just going to, you haven't even heard, God, what do you want from this relationship? Winks goes on and says this. He says, if God is what you turn to when all else fails, violence certainly functions as our God, doesn't it? What people, and this is fascinating, this could be a whole other sermon. What people overlook then is the religious character of violence, right? We turn to violence. That's like, oh, what do we do now? Let's go bomb something, right? What do we do now? Well, I'm going to cut that person off from our life. What am I going to, you know? It demands from its devotees absolute obedience unto death, right? So Jesus says, the first thing I want you to do is I want you to open up your ears and I want you to listen to God about what God might have for this, right? I love this because we go back to this. We kind of ask this question, hey, God, what do you want from this relationship? And how can I best give myself to bring that about? That person who now you're probably up to about 18, you're saying, not that person, surely not that person, right? You begin, I have this one guy that I ride with, and I cannot stand him. And even, I'm closing my eyes, and I see his face in my mind, and even right now in this moment, I'm thinking, surely not him, Lord. Everyone but him. Like, seriously, and like I'm like the pastor that, you know, like the, can't stand this guy. And I'm thinking like, so, oh, God, what do you want from that relationship? You know, the first thing Jesus says, I want you to begin by listening, by praying, by asking, what can I do to bring this about? So here's what prayer does, by the way. And this is why I think Jesus tells us to pray, because here's what prayer does. The first thing prayer accomplishes is it aligns our heart. Again, I'm sorry if this is just like, I know this is kind of like the church answer, like, hey, what should we do? Pray and read your Bible. But this is what Jesus says. So be serious about this, right? This isn't just good advice, again. This is good news, right? Jesus says to pray for these people. Why? Because prayer aligns our hearts with God. When I was thinking about this, we have, okay, I'll tell you this guy's name. His nickname is Lots, right? And when I think about myself and Lots, his last name is Lots, I think of myself on one team and him on the other team, right? He has nothing to do with me. He's away from me. I don't want anything to do with him, right? But then when I think about this guy, Lots, I realize we're all riding in the same group, right? Whenever you think about your enemy, I think one of the first things that it does is it aligns our hearts with God, and God says, no, I'm here for everybody, right? I'm here for the whole world. For the terrorists and for the child molesters and for the people who I don't like and for my neighbor down the street that annoys me and for that person at work who just talks all the time. I'm here for everybody, and we align our heart with God and we realize that we're all on the same team. 2 weeks ago when it was really hot and sweaty, how many people in those moments just found themselves getting more irritable towards people around them, right? Just a little bit, right? Come on, right? Remember that? It was like by Thursday, everybody's just completely fried. There's no more water left in our brain for the neurons to fire. I'm just generally, she's outside with the kids. I'm just generally irritable towards my wife during that week, you know, especially by the end of the week. And I remember I'm riding home from a ride and the Lord says to me, he says, Eric, but you guys are on the same team. You need her for the family to function at its best. You start thinking about that. I was like, okay, well, you have a choice. You can be irritable and resentful and cold towards your wife over the next couple days because of the heat and whatnot. Or you can say, look, Robin, it's been hard for both of us. You're in a classroom all day without air conditioning. I'm at home all day, and we've chosen the Summer Saver plan, so I sit without air conditioning at home. And we can be irritable towards one another, or we can come together and we can say, we're on the same team. And think about your enemy. Think about the person who by now it's 28 times you said, surely not him or her, Lord. And you think to yourself, we're on the same team. And prayer is what aligns our hearts with God to have those thoughts and those revelations. We need to begin. Jesus says you got to begin with prayer. The other thing that prayer does is it opens us up to receive love from God so that we can love our enemies. Again, a lot of us take this as just good advice, right? That's kind of nice. But when you pray and you say, Lord, seriously, lots? No way. But with you, I would say that, and I'll say that, that enemy love is impossible without the divine empowerment and love from the Holy Spirit, right? I have a friend this weekend who's doing an Ironman up in Tahoe. Now, imagine I said to you, hey, I want you to go do an Ironman tomorrow up in Tahoe. Just go try really hard. If you just try your hardest, surely you can go cycle 112 miles and run a marathon and then go for a 4-mile swim or however they do it, right? And you're like, all right, I'll go try, right? And probably most of you would drown somewhere in that 4-mile swim, right? But if I said to you, by the way, I'm going to give you a jet ski and then an electric bike and one of those Segways, you'd be like, ah, sounds a little tiring, but I think that actually sounds kind of fun, you know? We need that divine empowerment from the Holy Spirit to do this hard work of enemy love, right? Step by step, moment by moment, bit by bit. God, again, Jesus says pray, and it's just not the church answer. It's just not the Jesus answer. Jesus, I need you to empower me to love my enemy. I can't do it. I look at this guy's, I see this guy's face in my mind, and I'm like, I can't do it. But Jesus, maybe you can, bit by bit, moment by moment, ride by ride, I can do that. The last thing I think that prayer does is it reminds us, and Jesus kind of talks about this, that grace is always available to all. He says, God lets the sun rise on hill, the evil and the wicked. How often does the sun rise? Every day. Every day you'll have a reminder, right? Like an alarm clock, like a reminder on your phone. Every day you'll have a reminder that grace is available to that person, right? How often does it rain? Once a year. We have seasons of rain, right? But every time that rain comes on and you look across, I mean, imagine, you know, you look across the field at your neighbor in the first century. Dang it. It's raining on that person's field again. You know, but Jesus is like, it'll rain for them too. And grace is still available for that person. And maybe the evil hasn't completely choked out their heart, right? So Jesus says, I want you to pray. I want you to pray. I want you to pray. I'll say one last thing, and then we'll all tell stories about our enemies and the redemptive violence myths that we've tried on them. Jesus says this because it's so important for us to realize that at the end he kind of finishes with this whole, if you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than the others? Don't even the pagans do that? And he asks these series of rhetorical questions in which we say, oh, remember last week we talked the whole adultery thing we talked about. He asks these questions to kind of expose the fallacies, so to speak, of our thinking. Jesus is saying here in these last couple of rhetorical questions, he's saying, for me, right, I put it like this, enemy love displays a renewed heart of that divine love, right? It's almost as if you begin to love your enemies, and this is the tattoo, so to speak, that Jesus would use to identify his followers, right? Look, it's not hard to love people who love you back, right? Jesus says, I'll show you who my followers really are. The people who can stand in front of their enemy and love them back, right? This will be the mark of a true follower of Jesus. So you're thinking about that person now, right? And you're thinking to yourself, oh man, got some prayer to do. I'll close with this. I had this when I was a junior high pastor. We did this great example with this kid. It's kind of, I was thinking about doing it this morning, but it's a little maybe too juvenile. My wife got me a dartboard for one of the best gifts she got me. She's still not here. One of the best gifts that she got me, she got me a dartboard for one of my, I think it was one of my birthdays. And it was up in the garage, and it definitely increased the manliness of my garage by tenfold until we had a child and she moved her sewing machine right underneath it. So I had this dartboard, and I'd love to play darts in the garage. And I remember reading this professor did this at one point, in which he had his college students, he had them like, hey, draw a picture of your enemy, right? Draw a picture of someone who you really hate, right? And they all like kind of like drew these pictures and had these fun pictures. And then he had this dartboard. And again, I did this with the kids, right? It's like, draw a picture of someone who you really hate. Had this dartboard up in front of the class, and they pinned this person on the dartboard, right? And underneath, kind of behind the dartboard, he had another piece of paper. But, you know, all the kids are coming up and they're lobbing their darts at these persons. They're like, yeah, you got it right in the nose, right in the, you know, in the eyeball, you know, and everybody's kind of having a fun time, like throwing darts at their enemies. And then what I had ripped off from this professor is one of the things that we had done is we had put a picture of Jesus underneath these enemies, right? So there were like Jesus and then a white sheet and then, you know, and then kids realize that when they throw darts, right, when we're violent, when we think that we're going to change our enemy just by, we realize those troubling words from Jesus that what you've done to the least of these, you've done to me, right? And we had this great, you know, it's this great moment of like, the darts that you throw at your enemies, you're throwing at Jesus, right? And we needed that, we ended it with, what we're going to end with is just a time of prayer. Because Jesus says, I want you to pray for those people, right? I want you to really consider that grace hasn't completely left that person. I am going to choke down 7 words from my cycling friend here. Lots, right? And maybe that's all you got this morning is you can choke down 7 words of prayer for somebody, right? Maybe you can say like 4. Maybe you just got like grunts towards that person, right? But we'll just, Jesus, you just said, you know, pray for those people. Love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you. Pray for those people who put you down. Pray for those people who you just can't stand. Pray for those people who you think, gosh, I wish they didn't live next to me. Pray for those people who you think, I wish that person would get fired tomorrow morning, right? Pray for that person who you think, I hope that he gets hit by a car tomorrow morning when we're riding, right? Pray for that little girl when she interrupts your sermon and thinks that she's... Right? And you pray for your enemies. It's the simplest and most honest and the greatest thing that we can do, because love is still a thick force in the cosmos. You've had this person or group of people or persons running around in your head all morning long, right? Everybody had that person running around their head, right? And would you just take a moment, if it's a grunt or a couple words, if maybe there's not that person right now, the great enemy right now that we have set ourselves against as a nation is ISIS or these extreme terrorists or whoever it might be, and the Lord's put someone on your heart, carry a jab, the Lord's put someone on your heart, and you just pray for them. Right? You just pray for that person. Let's do that. Let's just take a couple minutes and pray for that person.